Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com.
Recorded live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
My name is Danielle Vogel, and you're listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio, a show about the little things you can do to minimize your personal carbon footprint. This show is all about empowering you to take control of the pace of environmental progress you're making just by being a little bit more mindful about the way you eat, drink, shop, and think. This isn't hard stuff, but we'll show you just how easy it can be when you know exactly which small things really do matter. If fighting climate change is something that's important to you, or possibly just something you're curious to learn more about, please consider subscribing to Everyday Enviro wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I'm joined by Erin Callahan, director of the Climate Collaborative. Erin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Danielle.
Really appreciate your time. I'm looking forward to learning from you. So, Erin, let's start from the beginning. Can you tell us what the Climate Collaborative is and what the group is looking to accomplish?
Absolutely. So we're a nonprofit, and we launched about 2.5 years ago, a little over that. And it was really to create a community within the natural products industry of companies who were looking to go deeper on climate action together. There was this really widespread recognition about 3 or 4 years ago that there were kind of two things happening in the industry. One, there were a lot of companies who were doing great things on climate, but they had no way to share their stories. Mm-hmm. And they were really working alone in silos, having to figure out everything on their own. It was very inefficient. And then secondly, because we work with small and medium-sized companies mostly, you know, it's the fastest growing part of the food sector, but it's full of small companies who are, you know, small but mighty and largely mission-driven. And these companies were increasingly figuring out that they needed to be doing a lot more on climate change, but didn't have clear pathways to act. And they didn't really, there was a big gap between knowing that they wanted to do something and figuring out what to do, how to build internal capacity, what to prioritize, where to act for impact.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
So we came in to really try and address those gaps. And so we created this roadmap of 9 commitment areas that address the key emissions drivers for companies. And we invite companies to make public commitments.
Awesome. And we'll actually talk through those one at a time in a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds great. Well, so in short, we just invite companies to make those commitments and then we help them on the implementation side. And that's really the full scope of our model. We want to invite companies, get on the path, make a public commitment, hold yourself to it, and then we help them build capacity, learn from each other, learn from experts, and also just share best practices and stories and try to break down some of those silos that we saw in the industry.
Awesome. Yeah, we don't all need to be reinventing the wheel in our own
Exactly. Yes. And we don't really have time for that.
No, we don't. And also, like, when the leaders do the hard stuff first, it makes it easier for the followers to jump on board at a lower cost most of the time.
Completely.
So when we're talking about either natural products or natural food leaders, are we talking about grocers or manufacturers, small producers? What's the scope of inclusion?
Very good question. So when we got started, it was largely a small group of brands, food brands. So, you know, Annie's, Organic Valley, Stonyfield, a lot of the brands probably people buy and shop from each week. But actually, we've expanded beyond that. And what we really want to do is bring the whole supply chain together. So we now do have farmers, producers, ingredients manufacturers, distributors, brands, and then we also have about 100 retailers who've made commitments as well. So we really want the whole supply chain involved because when you try to transform practices across an industry, you need the whole industry involved. And, you know, for brands anyway, most of their footprint is in their supply chain. Mm-hmm. It is through transportation. It's through growing the crops that then go into the food that they're selling. So the full supply chain aspect is a really crucial part of what we do.
100% agreed. Do you guys have any interest in expanding into the transportation sector?
It's a good question. Right now, transportation is one of the biggest challenges for our companies. And it's because we work with small companies who don't have their own fleets. So they're working with freight forwarders or they're shipping their products via UPS. So their options are a little bit limited. Mm-hmm. So the extent of transportation work that we've done so far has been focused on giving companies pathways regardless of what their transportation looks like mm-hmm. to do a bit better, whether it's through switching to intermodal or, you know, whatever it is, or kind of partnering with another brand like Organic Valley does with Go Macro in Wisconsin. There's a local brand nearby. So we do some stuff on that. And then we also do a lot of work on policy advocacy on the transportation front, since that's overall a really key piece of kind of moving the system.
And I guess you get at it certainly by partnering with distributors.
Yes, absolutely. So we work with Veritable Vegetable, for instance, in California, who was the first distributor to have an all-hybrid fleet. And so there's, you know, small examples that are really cool of distributors really trying to shift toward having smaller footprints and working with local growers and having kind of a new way of doing business on the distribution front.
For sure. And, you know, short of an electric fleet or a hybrid fleet, do you do any work with carbon offsets for transportation emissions?
We do. We work with a number of partners that can provide, work with companies to provide offsets that they're looking to offset their transportation. So we do connect companies to solutions on that front as well.
Very good. I would like to talk to you about that later because that's an interesting growth opportunity for us. So Erin, how many organizations have joined the Climate Collaborative so far?
Well, this is a really exciting thing for me to talk about now because we're 2.5 years in and it can be a really hard time for just organizations because you can slow down a lot, but we've just been picking up momentum. And so we're at almost 450 companies who've joined. It's 448 today.
Wow.
And they've made 1,716 commitments to action. And that's almost 2 a day since we launched. So what it shows is that there is a lot of momentum. And if you give companies a pathway and a kind of will to act, a kind of roadmap for doing that, the will is there. So that's been really exciting to see.
Awesome. And we're going to really get into specifics now because there are probably some listeners rolling their eyes and thinking it's a bunch of greenwashing, but we're going to teach you exactly how not greenwashing this is.
Yes.
These commitments are extremely tangible and measurable and ultimately impactful. So let's do that. Can you walk us through each of the commitments your members are asked to consider making? Let's start at the top with agriculture.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are 9 total commitments, and they span kind of looking at your supply chains and looking at your direct operations and then policy advocacy. So starting with agriculture, this to me is one of the most exciting opportunities. What we're asking companies to do is to commit to integrating carbon farming into the agricultural supply chain. We work with food and natural products companies. Nearly all of them have agricultural supply chains, and it all starts at the farm level. And if anyone is a fan of Paul Hawken or Project Drawdown, regenerative agriculture is number 11 on the list of solutions. He has this roadmap of 100 climate solutions. This is number 11. It's a huge opportunity. And, you know, we didn't kind of look at the big context. Probably a lot of listeners are aware, but the food system, when you count land use and deforestation, accounts for almost a fourth of global emissions. I mean, it's not small potatoes here. We're talking about 23% of global emissions, and that's just a very recent statistic from the latest IPCC report. So this is hugely material to kind of reversing climate change. And agriculture sits in the nexus of being this tremendous opportunity as a solution, but also a driver of climate change. And so what we're trying to do through this commitment is get companies to move from having agriculture within their supply chains be part of the problem to becoming part of the solution. And that really is through carbon soil sequestration.
So quickly, for those who don't speak these languages fluently, can you define the term carbon farming?
Absolutely. So basically, there are a set of practices that can help you turn soil into a carbon sink. So you can pull carbon down into the soil and keep it there, as opposed to a lot of kind of extractive practices through agriculture right now, which release carbon into the atmosphere and help contribute to global warming. And those practices include things like cover cropping, compost application. So it's a simple set of practices that can just keep your soil healthier and more productive, but also turn it into a carbon sink. And so we're kind of, this is a very robust area of activity right now for companies. And there's a lot happening right here and right now. And it's a huge area of opportunity, but it's very complicated. So we're helping companies navigate through this landscape of what is regenerative agriculture? How do you get involved? What does it look like? And, you know, as a lot of people are probably aware, there's a lot of certification systems. There's a lot of different practices. The picture is different if you're growing crops versus have a dairy or have a ranch. But there are opportunities regardless of where you sit and what type of product that you're growing or working the land with. And so we do a lot to help companies navigate through this and start to make practices that improve the quality of their soil and help sequester carbon. Just a couple of examples of what this looks like. The biggest impact one that we've seen and the biggest public announcement I've seen is General Mills, who, you know, Annie's who is owned by General Mills, was one of our first committed companies, and they really served as a kind of laboratory for what these practices could look like. They were acquired by General Mills, and General Mills has now, at the parent company level, made a commitment to transition 1 million acres to regenerative agriculture by 2030.
Awesome.
Yeah, these types of public announcements are really important, I think, in setting goals that, you know, you don't necessarily know how you're going to achieve, but you want to put your stake in the ground. Mm-hmm. They really matter in helping shift the rest of the industry. Dr. Bronner's and Patagonia are another two examples of companies who are actually helping define a whole new certification standard and really push the boundaries on what does leadership look like. Mm-hmm. And when you have companies doing that, you need platforms that also help explain and bring in other companies. And so that's something we're trying to be as well.
Certainly. So if, for instance, a retailer were to make the agriculture commitment within the Climate Collaborative, I would be needing to authenticate the farming practices of the farmers that I do business with? Is that how
it would look?
It's a
very good question. Yeah. So since we work with companies at every stage of the supply chain, the commitment itself looks a bit different for everyone, and companies can, to an extent, self-identify, what does this commitment mean for me, given where I sit in the supply chain? Mm-hmm. I know you have a perfect example of this, since Glenn's does such great work sourcing locally and working really closely to establish deep farmer relationships. For other retailers, it looks a bit different. So a couple of examples of what it looks like. Good Earth Natural Foods, which is here in the North Bay, close to where I am, they've done a lot of work trying to create, you know, retailer services, crucial link between brands and consumers. Mm-hmm. And they've done a lot of work trying to create an aware and conscious consumer base on why we should care about soil, how to make conscious purchasing decisions based on that knowledge. So they've done a huge amount of work to not only source locally and try really hard to bring regeneratively grown products into their store, but also help educate and create a consumer base who wants to purchase those products, in some cases is willing to pay a premium and is asking the right questions when they go into other stores. So I think for retailers, for instance, in this example, there's a work kind of up the supply chain, but also down it. Mm-hmm. And we try to get companies thinking about both sides of that.
That's a great point. So do you, not to put any more work on your plate, you are a very busy woman, but do you guys produce any sort of consumer education collateral that might help retailers tell that story?
It's a very good question, and it is something that we are doing this year. So we're actually right now, we're seeking funding, but we are going to be launching a consumer engagement aspect of the project. It's always been kind of a missing link in what we wanted to do, and we're working with a fabulous partner here in the Bay Area, Guru Media, and we're looking for partners to help try. We've got about over 100 companies who are willing and interested in working together to use a common set of language mm-hmm. When talking about climate change, and also work together on consumer campaigns, and again, in a common voice, to help educate and engage consumers in a dialogue that isn't kind of talking down to them, but is really bringing them into the conversation and saying, we have to figure this out together. Mm-hmm. We aren't telling you what to do. We want you to tell us your needs. We'll tell you our needs, and let's kind of move forward together. And so that's our goal through the project. We also really want to go deeply on things like packaging, soil health, food mm-hmm. waste, issues that are really consumers are a big part of the problem. And again, just like with agriculture, can also be part of the solution. So we're really hoping to get that off the ground in 2020.
I would love to help with that.
I would love to have you.
Yeah, it's like one of my
sure
favorite
wonderful ideas and examples.
Thank you. Yeah. One of my favorite activities is sort of translating the climate policy work into digestible language. So I'm there for that. We were all talking about the first commitment, which is sort of under the umbrella of agriculture. The next commitment is energy efficiency. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, sure. So energy efficiency, this is more, so when you look at your operations, if you're a company, you can break it down into, if you're getting technical, three scopes: direct, indirect, and then supplier, large, direct and indirect emissions. And then with indirect, there's a large scope of which ones do you have control over and which ones don't you? And how do you influence most of the things you have control over? Mm-hmm. For energy efficiency, people have control over it. This is things like changing your light bulbs, trying to get your building LEED certified. It's kind of working within your direct operations and seeing what changes you can make. This is easier for companies depending on whether they own or lease their buildings. So with all of these commitments, it really quickly gets to a level of complexity that can scare you away if you're kind of staring down. You know, it can seem like a really monumental task if you don't own the building you're in, for instance, to want to improve your building's energy efficiency.
Yeah.
But there are ways to do that. And so with commitments like this, we try to both connect companies to clear resources and partners that provide, especially in some cases, free support. Pace and Boulder County is a perfect example. They are part of Boulder County government, work really closely with them, and provide free consulting And they've done so to over 60% of businesses in Boulder County on how to increase energy efficiency in buildings. And
awesome.
So there are some great programs, and sometimes there's just a gap between knowing what the access is that can actually then really easily help you make changes that are pretty easy.
See, for me, this is the most economically efficient commitment that a company can
totally.
Make because it's all about controlling the controllables. And at the end of the day, when you make the decision to replace the light bulb, you're reducing your energy costs over time. This is the easiest sell for the skeptics, I think.
I completely agree. It's such a good on-ramp commitment because it directly is also saving you money.
Exactly.
Couldn't agree more.
Exactly. You get a very fast ROI on that one. Okay, moving through. Next is one near and dear to my heart, food waste.
Yes, this is one that we've been doing a lot of work on this year with retailers in particular. So this one is all about reducing food waste in the supply chain. As everyone knows, about 40% of our food, well, people might not know, but about 40% of our food is wasted. And that is a huge problem. And when we look at the problem in the agricultural system, it's not just agricultural practices. A huge part of it is that we grow a lot of food that never gets eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens at every stage of the supply chain. But retailers are actually a huge part of this commitment. So we worked really closely with retailers on this. What we did this year was we brought on a food waste expert, Dana Gunders, who is just a huge champion. And we did in-person consultations at retailers around the U.S. And from that, developed a best practice guide for retailers on how to reduce food waste in their stores and work with brands and distributors to improve inventory management.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not just divert waste? So a lot of what we see, especially with retailers, is that they're really good at waste diversion, which means their waste doesn't end up in the trash, but it's often going to compost or being donated.
Yep.
And it's great to donate food. But what's even better is to not have waste to begin with. And so we've been trying to really help retailers focus less on diversion and how do we reduce the amount of waste created in the first place. And that comes through tracking systems, inventory management, how you stage it on the floor, how you communicate with customers about it. Again, consumer engagement comes into this. How do you tell consumers how to store their avocados better so that they don't throw them away because they go black within 2 days?
Mm-hmm.
So we created a set of best practices that help retailers kind of navigate through some of those challenges.
This one is both semi-complicated and also extremely easy. It's complicated because we're in the food business, right? So people want to approach geometric, bountiful displays of food that are appetizing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have enough food to make the display bountiful, it's not as appetizing. And if you end up ordering to ensure that you sell only what you sold the week before, you're going to miss out on sales because somebody comes to buy the thing and you don't have the thing to sell them because you're worried about controlling food waste. We've just taken the position that that's the way we are at Glenn's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, like we're adapting our orders for things like weather and holidays and all that sort of thing. But for the most part, like we're really tracking very, very tight to what we know we can sell so that we don't generate
mm-hmm.
food waste in the first place. But the other side of that is it is absolutely crazy in an industry where profit margins are 1% to even think about buying heavy and creating food waste, because then you've paid the vendor to create the food, you've paid the distributor to transport the food, you've paid your receiver to get it into the building, your stocker to stock it, and then your stocker
mm-hmm.
again to unstock it, and then your waste hauler to carry it away, you know, like even if it's compost. So again, there's like definitely an economic efficiency argument to be made for encouraging food waste sort of consciousness. But from a retailing and merchandising perspective, like it's a tough sell to retailers that for generations have made, you know, a good living on making sure that their displays are full and irresistible. One of the ways we work around it is we just do like false risers and things like that to make the
mm-hmm.
displays look more full even when they're not. What other best practices do you guys recommend for food waste minimization?
Yeah, so inventory management and better forecasting is a huge one. So for a lot of small and medium-sized retailers, for instance, some of them even still track everything by paper. So it's not digitized. They're not really tracking waste. And so there's a huge amount that can just happen if you actually try to track forecasting and inventory management year over year. So you do better ordering. So you're ordering with the most amount of efficiency possible.
Yeah.
There are some retailers that we work with where, you know, there's a lot of retailers, for instance, in the North Bay, where they're hugely dependent on hiking. And so if it's a good weather weekend versus a bad weather
mm-hmm.
weekend, it can change everything.
Totally.
And so there are some kind of events like that that make it really hard. But inventory management is one of the biggest. And then second, reuse food as it gets close to
mm-hmm.
spoiling or
mm-hmm.
put it on sale. There's a retailer here again in San Francisco who has an in-house forager. And their job is to work across all categories within the store to find food that is about to be spoiled and find a way to reuse it. So bring it to the deli and say, here's what we have today. Yep. What can we do with it? And their job is to just kind of figure out what this is. And so that's one very cool example.
And by the way, just for retailers that might be listening, like, you don't actually have to pay a person's salary to do that. We've empowered all of our teams to do that. So when the floor team finds a tomato that isn't looking its best, they write it down, they take the weight, you know, we transfer it to a cull log, and then they walk it right back to the deli. You don't need to foot a bigger bill for labor in order to accomplish that. It's just a matter, it's a matter of culture and training your team to understand how the food should flow throughout the store.
It's such a good point. And we visited two retailers who I think both are exemplifying really leading good practice, if not best practice, when it comes to food waste management. And it's Buyright and Canyon Market.
Oh, my gosh, two of my favorites in the whole wide world. In the whole world.
Yes, they're fantastic. But it was really funny because they managed food waste in very different but both highly effective ways. So Buyright, you know, Sam, the head of the store and store owner, has just been fantastic at creating a really strong company culture where everyone feels bought into the mission. And the staff, you know, they have free meals together every day. And reducing food waste is just really part of the company ethos. And Canyon Market, which again is also just displaying real best practice on what this looks like, they're the ones who have the in-house forager. They are, I've never seen a store their size who does the amount of tracking that they do. They track food waste across every category of the store. They measure it. They make it public. They have it posted. Everyone can see. And it's kind of almost created this sense of competition of how do we get it down? How do we get these numbers down? And that level of transparency has been really effective. And what that showed me is there's multiple ways in to do this and kind of figure out what's worked best for the store. It can be culture. It can be tracking and data. It can be both. But they're both just doing such great work on it. Berkeley Bowl in Berkeley is another great example. They just put all their produce on sale and sell it at a reduced rate and let you know that it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. And that has been such a successful model that they had to add on a whole new room to the store because so many people were going after the reduced price produce.
Wow.
And so they're still able to sell it. Consumers are aware and expect it to be less than perfect. They bag it up so that consumers can't, you know, choose an apple from the rest of the produce department and say, hey, this one doesn't look perfect.
Right.
They do that segmentation,
right.
And it's been a huge business driver for them.
That's awesome. But that's yet another good point about how you can achieve an economically efficient result while also achieving an environmental result. So our food waste protocols at Glenn's were actually modeled totally on the Canyon Market protocol. I sent my grocery buyer at the time out to work with Richard and Janet for a whole week at Canyon Market to learn how they do this. And she brought it back to DC. So I'm like the biggest fan of Canyon Market and Buyright.
It really felt like a masterclass getting to sit down with both of them for a couple of days and just look at the depth of study and complexity and sophistication that they brought to thinking about how to reduce this. And for Canyon especially, I mean, it was really, they were very clear, you know, we don't want to waste food. That is money. Food is money. We have small margins. We need to get better at this. And this isn't just because we care about the earth and we care about not wasting food. It also makes business sense. And I think when you can make those two things go hand in hand, it's really hard to not make a case for doing a bit better.
That's a good point. All right, let's go on to the next commitment. It's forests. That's a big word. What are you talking about?
It's a very big word. So right here, I think this can kind of be encompassed to take on a lot, and companies have a lot of approaches to reforestation, afforestation, and working in agroforestry management systems, which we're seeing increasingly in this part of the industry. This commitment, the original intent, and I would say it's expanded beyond that, is companies just really delve into how to better manage forests through which they're sourcing. This really looks at sourcing. How are you sourcing any commodity that could be linked to deforestation? So soy, palm oil, leather, how are you sourcing, and paper, so timber, any products that you have in your supply chain, are you really sure that those aren't contributing to deforestation? And that's really the core of what this commitment is looking at the start. Like I said, it's expanded beyond that, as I think that in setting an agroforestry management system that Dr. Bronner's and Alterico are kind of really going deeply on. But it really starts with sourcing. Look deeply at your sourcing. Make sure that what you're doing isn't contributing to major problems within deforestation systems globally, and start to ask the right questions and work with your suppliers.
Cool. So we are only about halfway through the commitments list. I want to remain respectful of everyone's time. So first of all, you can check out the Climate Collaborative website. Erin, hit us up with the URL for that.
It is climatecollaborative.com.
Awesome. And then just to bring everybody onto the same page, the remaining commitments are packaging, policy, renewable energy, short-lived pollutants, and transportation. Erin, are there any of those that you just want to share quick anecdotes about? Are any of them not to be missed?
Well, packaging is the single biggest challenge area for companies. Mm-hmm. It's the most visible representation on the consumer end of the footprint of what they're purchasing. And so, and it's a huge challenge because, you know, you were laying this out a bit with food waste, where retailers don't want to have empty shelves. In the same way, one, you have to have a package, mm-hmm. But also it has to keep the food within the package shelf stable. It has to have a good design that will make people want to buy it. There are so many elements, and there's so much complexity in packaging. And on the solution side, you know, no one wants to buy plastic anymore. Glass is really heavy and can break. Compostable is great, but only about 2% of the U.S. has composting infrastructure at an industrial scale. So what the solutions then become incredibly complex. So that's all to say that this is an incredibly ripe area of work for us, where companies are really struggling, really wanting to move forward together. And so we do a lot in that sphere. So one other thing I would just say is policy. I mean, I think, you know, every company in our industry could get to net zero emissions, and it would be a drop in the bucket globally. And so local, state level, hopefully at some point federal policy is absolutely critical to helping transform this beyond our industry and create a virtuous cycle wherein business pushes better policy that then pushes broader business action and so on and so forth. So that's the ultimate hope, and that's where the policy commitment sits.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think municipal, state, and regional is the way to go at the moment.
Yeah.
We do not have a Congress that is leaning forward with us on this stuff right now, which is why Glen's Garden Market exists. But anyway.
Thank God it does.
So in terms of these commitments, how is performance measured with regard to commitment compliance?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So once a year, we send out a questionnaire to companies. It's a short survey. We aren't meant to be a reporting platform. And in fact, you know, there are a lot of reporting platforms. A lot of the companies that we work with are B Corp certified. A lot of them report through SFTA, one of our project partners. So there are a lot of reporting mechanisms out there. We did not want reporting to get in the way of progress. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of our companies, they're behind on target setting relative to, if you look at Fortune 500 companies, we didn't want them to be behind on action. And so we are very action focused, but we realize the importance of accountability mechanisms and ultimately that what gets measured gets managed, mm-hmm. and you need that kind of push toward metrics eventually built in. So what we do is we ask companies once annually, we check in for each of their commitments and say, where are you in implementation? Are you measuring progress? And explain what that looks like. And so it gives companies some leeway if they haven't done a lot of measurement to still say, here's what we are doing, or we're still in the planning phase. And so that's been our primary way of getting feedback on where companies are so far. Yeah. And it's, you know, right now, we ask companies each year, and we have a lot of new companies come in each year. So this year we did the survey and found that 71% of the companies that we're working with are actively implementing the projects that they've committed to implement.
Awesome.
The other 29% are somewhere in the planning stages, figuring out what it's going to be looking like, or they might have been acquired and are going through a merger process or something like that. But the rest are a mixed bag. But it's great to see that progress, and that's an improvement from the previous year.
And you're keeping it on their radar screens, importantly.
Exactly. Yeah.
So before we go to break, just what's the process for joining Climate Collaborative?
We've tried to make that very easy. Firstly, it's free, which is huge. We really didn't want cost to be a barrier for entry. So you just have to go to our website and fill out a short form, signify which commitments you want to be making, and tell us a bit about your current practices. It takes about 5 minutes to fill out.
Couldn't be easier than that.
Yeah.
All right. So we're talking with Erin Callahan. She's the director of the Climate Collaborative, about her work to harness the natural foods community to reduce climate impacts in our sector. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, we'll get into how the work this group is doing impacts you. Back in a sec. Welcome back. This is Everyday Enviro, a show about the small things you can do to reduce your personal carbon footprint. I'm Danielle Vogel, founder of Glen's Garden Market, and I'm joined today by the brilliant Erin Callahan, director of the Climate Collaborative. We've been talking about the intentions and implications of the collaborative, and now we're going to give you some tips about how you can use what you've learned today to reduce your personal carbon footprint. So, Aaron, you spend a lot of time activating around how business leaders can adapt their operations to achieve emissions reductions. What advice do you have for listeners about how they can achieve the same goals on a personal level?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, probably all of us, I feel like there's been a big shift this year where I do get a sense that more than ever, people are really asking themselves this question and feeling bereft and out of control of their footprint and what they can do about it. And ultimately, of course, we need larger systems change, but it's so important to feel like you can hold yourself accountable and do something to contribute toward these actions. So I love that you focus the show this way. I think it's such a nice framing for how we can make small changes. I think there's a lot we can do as consumers. Purchasing patterns drive change on the business end. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that the natural products industry is the fastest growing part of the food sector is really important. It means that consumer awareness is shifting toward preferring organic, preferring locally grown. Those are really great trend lines. And, you know, more than ever, also, people are voting with their dollars. When you look at recent studies, you know, 7 out of 10 millennials are willing to pay more for products that were produced in environmentally conscious ways.
Yeah,
and that gets alignment. Even higher. Yeah, exactly. That gets even higher when you look at younger generations. So these trend lines are shifting, and that's great to see. And I think it's important for us to bring some consciousness into our purchasing. There's a lot of complexity. It's a lot to hold when you go to the grocery store and you're looking at price point, you're looking at taste, you're looking at a lot of convenience. I think those are probably the three biggest things.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And then beyond that, to then have to ask questions about whether it was ethically produced, whether it was sustainably sourced. It's a lot to hold in your mind. It can get very complicated. So it's in part on part of brands to help tell those stories and make it a bit easier. And that's something we're trying to do.
Certainly.
But if you're a customer, I think, you know, you guys make it really easy at Glenn's. Try to buy local. Try to buy organic. Try to look into the companies that you're purchasing from and see what their products are. There is a movement toward transparency in supply chains and sourcing. And that is to our benefit. You can often Google companies and figure out information about their practices. And it can really help you then inform your purchases. And, you know, do that. Do that and then try to make purchases accordingly and try to talk to people and ask questions and be curious. At the grocery store, you know, give feedback to companies, ask companies questions. Companies want to be hearing more. Mm-hmm. And especially sustainability managers within companies, they are dying to have more consumers send in questions to their companies asking about environmental practices. And so, you know, that helps drive change internally. It helps give them a reason. So asking questions, being aware, being curious, and acting on that curiosity are all really, really helpful.
We are of completely the same mind on that question.
Good.
I agree completely. Like, show a preference for local and organic, do your homework, and make sure your values aligned with the company you're buying from, and then finally ask questions when you know the answer. You know, in Washington, saying you don't know is like toxic language. You must say always it's unclear. You never admit that you don't know. But for crying out loud, like,
yes.
We have so many resources at our disposal. Like, these questions can be answered, but there's no pressure on the business to act properly if nobody's watching. So hold them to account.
Yeah. And climate change is such a complex issue that the complexity can scare people away from even acting on it or asking the right questions because it's assumed that we should know or it's a little too complicated and we don't want to admit ignorance. And I think that we just don't have time for that. The scale of the problem is too big, and we do have to start having these difficult conversations and making ourselves educated. And that only comes through having even awkward conversations with people. So I'm hugely supportive of this.
Heard, chef. So with regard to aligning our spending with our values, in your opinion, which companies, either within the collaborative or not, do you think most represent climate best intentions realized? Meaning, which brand should we seek out if we're looking to endorse climate considerations in commerce?
Yeah.
Patagonia, well, you know, we know Patagonia all day.
Yes. Patagonia is incredible. We had Yvonne Chouinard speak at an event that we hosted last year, and it was incredible. There's no better example of a founder and of a company or of a company that is just so deeply committed. I mean, they've made climate change the mission of their company, and that is incredible. There's a lot of other companies doing great work. You know, we have 450. A lot of those are forward-looking commitments, so our commitments aren't endorsements. I mean, that's really important. But I would say, you know, each year we give out awards to 8 companies that are really exemplifying best practice. And this would be the easiest list to point to because we've given out 16 so far, including one to Glenn's last year. And I know Paul Hawken of Project Drawdown has something wonderful to say about the way that you guys are running your store. But there are a lot of other companies doing great work. Dr. Bronner's is one example. I mentioned them earlier with in reference to Patagonia. They are doing an incredible amount to walk the walk and creating a humane supply chain that sources everything as sustainably as possible. They want consumers to use less of their product. Mm-hmm. They want them to buy in bulk. They want it to last a long time, and they want it to be as sustainably sourced as possible. And they do a great job educating their consumers and their own voice, and they do a lot on the policy engagement front. So they're a wonderful example of a company doing a lot of great work. Alter Eco, the chocolate company, is another very cool example. Oh, You've probably seen their truffles in the grocery store checkout line. Mm-hmm. They are compostable overwraps to those truffles. And so I think you can feel very, very good about that. You know, there's a lot of other ones. Sambazon is another. We gave them an award this year for engaging their consumers on climate. They source acai berries from the Amazon, and they're really committed to reducing deforestation. And so they challenge their consumers to dye their hair purple and post a picture. And for everyone who did it, they would protect an amount of acres in the Amazon. They found someone to match the giving level that they had committed to, and they were able to protect over 125,000 acres.
That is awesome. How many people dyed their hair purple? Do you know?
I don't know the exact number. I wish that I did. But it really exceeded their expectations. And I think it did so because it was fun. It was engaging. It brought people into the mission. It didn't make them feel shamed for their actions. It made them want to proactively do something that was fun and think about it. It got them thinking about where the products that they're buying are coming from. It was a really cool campaign all around.
I love that. All right. So Finally, Erin, this is a show about minimizing our personal carbon footprint. What are some things that you do in your own life to reduce your environmental impact?
That's a good question. One of the biggest struggles for me, to be honest about where I might be failing, is that I just moved from New York to California a year ago, and I went from taking public transit everywhere to having to rely on a car. So that's been a real shift. But, you know, I'm really trying to be a lot more conscious about my transportation footprint. That's the biggest part of most people's footprint. So whenever I can take public transit, I really try to. If I don't have to fly somewhere, I really try to. That's another really hard one because I love travel. And then with the food I eat, certainly, being in this job has made me so much more conscious of everything that I put in my mouth. But buying locally and getting to know the companies that I work with has been such a fun and fulfilling journey. This part of the industry is full of people who really deeply care. They want to be having these types of conversations. We're all sustainability nerds, and they like having conversations about their supply chains. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a rich, wonderful part of my move out here and getting to know the companies that I work with a little bit better. It's just been a really fun way to care more and to make better decisions about, you know, the food that I'm purchasing. Same with clothing. There's an increasing amount of clothing companies who have, you know, been increasingly open about their sustainability, and I try to be really conscious about that. I would say with all my shopping, I try to be pretty conscious now. And when it's easy to make the right decision, I definitely do so. And even when it's not, I'm increasingly trying to.
Awesome. Well, I'll be out in San Francisco in January for the Good Food Awards. Maybe we can take a field trip to Bayreuth together.
I would love that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Erin. I learned a ton, and I'm so appreciative of your time. You're clearly a very busy climate champion.
Thank you. It's always so wonderful talking to you. I really appreciate it.
For sure. So, gang, climate change is real. It's happening right now, and human activity is making it worse. Every little bit counts. Keep finding little ways to minimize your personal carbon footprint. It really matters, and it's urgently necessary. Thank you so much for being here today, Erin, and thank you for listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio. If you like the show, please consider subscribing. And if you have an idea for a show or a guest, or you have a question about how you can reduce your personal carbon footprint, just hit me up by email. I'm at glensmarket@gmail.com. In any event, we'll catch you again next week on Everyday Enviro. Talk then. Bye, friends.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.